Welcome you to the first in our series, Space 1979. My name is Jim Wilding. I'm an itinerant minstrel of space popularization and I work at the Planetarium at the University of Michigan, and some of you may have heard me on National Public Radio, some of you may have heard me give lectures elsewhere. You know, I get around all over the place that's impossible to explain to people who don't know who I am, but that's who. The reason that we called the series Space 1979, aside from the obvious rip-off from the television series title, is that it happened that next year, or more accurately, the 10-month period beginning in December of this year and running through September of 1979, is going to be a period which is literally without any sort of precedent in the history of space, and that is a 20-year history now, so it's not too ridiculous to talk about without precedent in the entire history of space. In fact, in case anybody lost track, yesterday was the 20th anniversary of the launch of the first U.S. satellite, Explorer 1, and that will give you some idea of how far we've come in that period. And next week's lecture about space colonization will give you an idea of how far we can go if politicians like us in the next 20 years, because we would be talking about our first space colony about 20 years from now, a little bit more than 20 years from now. So this is a kind of nice date to have this particular spectacular series of events. It's more or less coincidence they are all coming together at this time, but they are. What you've got in that 10-month period is the following. Pioneer Venus, the next U.S. planetary mission, the first mission devoted primarily to the atmosphere of another planet, as opposed to the surface and interior, which we tend to concentrate on up until now. The last total solar eclipse visible in the contiguous United States in this century from parts of the Pacific Northwest. The first flyby of Jupiter and the very incredible moons by the first of the two Voyager spacecraft. That will give us coverage, well, two flybys in 1979, Jupiter's moons. Together, they will give us coverage of most of the surface of the moons, and of five of the moons, and all of the surface of Jupiter, with about the same kind of detail as you can see in the best photographs of our own moon taken through the best telescopes on Earth. And most of those objects, the five moons, are literally unknown at the present time. They're simply dots of light in our best telescopes. The one thing that we do know about them is they are really incredible bodies. They are so alien, they're so different compared to things we've explored up until now, that they make Mars and the Earth and Venus look similar by comparison. They are not, most of them aren't even made of rock. Ganymede, for example, one of the moons, is almost entirely liquid water, a drop of water bigger than the planet Mercury. And Io, which is another of the moons, is made of rock, but is covered by red radioactive salt, and it has an atmosphere which freezes solid and falls on the ground four times a week. Not to mention Jupiter itself, which is so huge that we're hollow, you can drop it 1,000 Earths and have room left over. And a little detail of the Great Red Spot, which is a super hurricane in its atmosphere, a single storm 2.5 times the diameter of the Earth, and it's been going at 500 miles an hour. It's been going in Jupiter's atmosphere for at least 3 centuries now, and there is no reason to assume that it is going to stop at all. It may be going for millions of years for all we know, and the telescopes for 3 centuries. So, you see, I think the Voyager flybys are going to be pretty interesting. There is the first, since I mentioned there was a second Voyager flyby, even though that's out of chronological sequence, let's count that as number 4. The first Voyager orbit of the space shuttle, which is going to revolutionize space flight, that's what you're going to hear about today, that'll be number 5. The second and third flight into orbit of the space shuttle. For an astronomy geek such as myself, something else is exciting, although it's not a space event, and that is the first meeting of the International Astronomical Union, the World Convention of Astronomers, on this continent since 1961. And the next meeting at Princeton concerning space colonization, which we're going to hear about next week. And then, by way of capping off this 10-month period, the arrival of the first spacecraft at Saturn, Pioneer 11. I am hoping to spend most of that period on the road as a nomad, going from one to another, living in my car, in fact, a good part of the camping, and gathering data and bringing lots and lots of material back to you so that I can tell you what happened the same way as you did for biking. And I imagine some of you, I know some of you, in fact, were at the series of lectures that I did here at Frankfurt last year on the Bugs and Mars findings. Lots and lots of good things are going to be happening. What this series is for is to give you a preview of most of those events. We are leaving out the Voyager flybys and we're leaving out Pioneer 11. In other words, we're leaving out everything in the outer solar system beyond the orbit of Mars. And the reason for that is because I already had given a lecture 2 years ago at Cranbrook on the outer solar system. And we just didn't have time to cover everything. If we were going to leave out something, it seemed reasonable to do that. For those of you who missed that lecture, however, or for those of you who heard it right here some more anyway, there isn't a good deal of updated material. If you are willing to drive to East Lansing, which is not all that far away from here, it could be worse, I am giving a lecture series which is open to the public and which is free once a month at Michigan State University. And the information about that, it just happens that the next two lectures cover that material. One of them is called Jupiter, and that will be coming up on February 9th. And the other one is called Beyond Jupiter, and it will cover Saturn and beyond, and including the rings of Uranus, which we discovered last year, and all kinds of things like that. And that will be on March 9th. All the information about that, about other lecture series that I'm giving in a number of different places around southeastern Michigan this particular period, and about all of the things that have to do with astronomy, which are open to the public and which happen at the University of Michigan campus in Ann Arbor. All of that information is on a mimeographed handout, and there's going to be a pile of those in the back of the room, and you are most welcome to grab one. You can go out, or if you have friends who live in some of these other cities who might be interested, or friends who live in this city for that matter, please feel free to take several. The only reason we didn't put them out there on the way in was we figured the people who didn't know what they were took them and turned it not to want them were throwing away. So we give you a warning about what they were first. The outline of this lecture series is going to be the following. Tonight we have a lecture about the space shuttle. Next time we have a lecture about something which is not going to happen in 1979, but is an extremely important topic, and it seemed worthwhile including it. Because it is a follow-on, it is something that shows will happen next year, is going to lead to, and that is the possibility of colonization of space, which could happen as early as the early 1990s, if we were to get moving and start doing something about it. That is the next week's lecture. Then there are two lectures about the planet Venus, which the first will be primarily concerned with the atmosphere, which is quite incredible, and the second will be primarily concerned with the surface, which is quite mysterious. And of course, the purpose of that will be to introduce you to Pioneer Venus, but in fact, the majority of the material will be to tell you what we already know about it, including the results from the four Russian landings on the surface of Venus, which have already happened, and which our news media have given the usual spectacular coverage to the extent that most people don't even know the Russians did land. They did it before we landed on Mars. In fact, man's first landing on the surface of another planet, which was November 7, was in December of 1970. And so it was 7 years ago that the Russians first landed on Venus. And it made page 57 of the New York Times. And since then, they have landed a few more spacecraft, which the last two sent back actual pictures from the surface. And I will describe those pictures in some detail in the second lecture. The final lecture on March 1st will be an introduction to the eclipse of February 26th of next year, and tell you where to go to see it and tell you how to see it in safety. It is one of the most spectacular sights in nature. If you possibly can get to it, I highly recommend that you do, but you gotta know what to do or you might come back blind. And we'll tell you about all that. So, that is the introduction. That's what you're in for the next 5 weeks, God and the rest of you are willing, and there's a really severe blizzard on this incredible planet. I mean, imagine water freezing and falling out of the sky. You don't have any well on planet. Venus has a nice, warm surface, pleasant 900 degree temperature, and on its mountain. irrigate your crops with molten lead all the time. You don't have any worries about seeing the progress.
Space.
Remember, please, NASA is National Aeronautics and Space Administration. They do aeronautics as well. So the amount of money we're already spending on those things is just so enormous that, contrary to very widespread belief, it would not, well, if we diverted the entire space budget into it, it would increase this budget by 2%. Or by less than that, if you consider education as a social program also. And I've included the defense budget as well, because you constantly hear the phrase space and defense, as though they have something in common. Well, what they have in common is they're somewhat similar colors on my chart. In fact, this particular year, we spent 27 times as much on what we laughingly refer to as defense as we did on NASA. That number has gone up somewhat too, and I believe it's something like 33 in the budget that President Carter just submitted. And finally, I put in a few consumer luxury items, again, not to criticize them. I wouldn't dream of criticizing money spent on alcohol, for example, or even money spent on education, even though it is more addictive and probably more socially damaging in the long run. Again, the idea is simply to point out that you can make an arithmetic point and you indicate that the whole either-or question, or either space or welfare, either one thing or another, is not so much wrong as irrelevant. We can very easily afford both. In fact, this number here is misleading because we didn't even spend that much on space in that particular year or in other years. In contrast to every other item on the chart, space expenditures pay for themselves many times over. The most recent study of the effects of NASA expenditures, which was done 4 years ago now by Chase Econometrics, concluded that for every $1 billion we spend on NASA, we get back into the economy over about the next 15 years a total of $14 billion just in the spin-off. The value to the economy of the new technology, which is developed as accidental byproducts of solving all the tens of thousands of engineering problems that are needed to go to the moon or land on Mars or send a spacecraft to Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus, whatever it is that we're doing. The most spectacular example of that is probably the pocket calculator industry, which is already a $2 billion a year industry, but there are tens of thousands of others, most of them individually unspectacular. But it turned out, to everybody's astonishment, I mean, that nobody realized anything like a 14-to-1 return. The most that NASA was hoping out of that study was, you know, maybe we'll turn out we get some of the money back. Nobody ever dreamed to pay for itself that well. The cumulative effect of them is really very spectacular. There was another economic study that was done about the same time, which I'd like to draw to your attention also, and that showed that what they did was compare what happens if you spend an additional $1 billion on NASA with what happens if you spend it somewhere else in the federal budget, and they found that NASA is almost the only place where increases in expenditure would decrease both inflation and unemployment. Usually, you decrease one at the expense of increasing the other, the trade-off. And the reason for that is that most other federal expenditures, and again, this is not a criticism, this is a description of facts, are not creation of new wealth the way NASA expenditures are. They are simply shifting existing wealth from one place in the economy to another place in the economy. And that's fine, but you've got to have a lesson somewhere, and it turns out that NASA generates it in quite a spectacular way. So, that is all that has to be said, I think, about the cost of space, and having gotten that out of the way, I hope we can now get into the fun part, which is the science, and so let me do that now. This is what the space shuttle would look like, cut away. The orbiter portion is the part that you've probably all seen on television being tested last summer in the California desert, and invariably the news media described those as tests of the space shuttle. And they said how 747 took the space shuttle up to 105 miles and released it and came down to a landing on the desert floor. Even my own network, National Public Radio, said that, even though I had specifically told them not to and made a big point of it in my report. I was there for the first test, in fact, for the second test as well, and I made a point of telling them there not to say that and of not referring to the thing as the shuttle, referring to it as the orbiter. They edited out of the broadcast version everything that I said about that, and then introduced it as a test of the space shuttle, and then put me on, and we were talking about something called an orbiter, and people all over the country must have been wondering what in heaven's name an orbiter was supposed to be. All they got was a space shuttle. Well, the fact is that the orbiter is the most important part of the shuttle. It is the only part that goes all the way into space, and therefore the only part that has to come back all the way through the Earth's atmosphere. It is the part that carries the people, it's the part that carries the cargo, but it is not the entire shuttle, and in particular, it is not capable of getting into orbit or getting so much as an inch above the ground by itself. It has no fuel tanks. You're used to seeing a rocket, which is primarily fuel tanks. When I say fuel, I'm speaking loosely. I really mean fuel and oxidizer, because there is no air in space, and so you've got to carry along something to burn the fuel in. And so, for example, the Saturn V, which you're probably familiar with as the Apollo moon rocket, had three stages, of which the first stage used for an oxidizer, a big tank of liquid oxygen, and for fuel. You never guess what incredible, miracle discovery of the latest chemical technology they used. Kerosene. Huge tank of kerosene down there in the bottom, and they burn that in liquid oxygen. The other two stages use liquid hydrogen for fuel, and again liquid oxygen to burn it in. So you really don't say fuel, you say propellant. Most of the inside of a rocket is these enormous fuel tanks, and that is not true of the orbiter portion of the shuttle. The fuel and propellant tank is a separate thing, which is called the external tank because it is on the outside of the orbiter. It is this portion that is back here. And so far, that has never been fastened to an orbiter, nor will it be, in fact, until later this year. And even then, that will just be recessed on the ground. Those will be of a different kind, less spectacular, down at Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. And even that is not enough to get the shuttle, the complete shuttle, off the ground at the beginning, when the tank is full of fuel and oxidizer, and therefore is at its heaviest. And so to help get it off the ground and get it up to the first 27 miles of altitude, there are two additional portions which strap on to either side of the external tank, and those are called the solid rocket boosters, and that's exactly what they are. They're additional solid fuel rockets. So the whole thing is an incredible looking device. It's something that's going to take some getting used to. You're used to seeing rockets that have multiple stages and that are in what is called a series configuration, with one stage parked on top of the next one, and the whole thing takes off vertically, and the first stage burns all of the fuel and oxidizer and falls completely free before the second stage is capable of firing at all. The second stage can't fire until the first stage is dropped off. The shuttle is going to do something which, in fact, has been done before. The Russian standard launch rocket has used it all along. A number of our unmanned rockets have been using it, but those are all familiar than the Saturn power rockets, and so you're not as used to it. It's called a parallel configuration, in which both the first stage and the second stage are firing simultaneously. There are advantages and disadvantages in the engineering design to both of those configurations, and it's really almost a toss-up in a given case which one is used. The decision is made on rather fine criteria. Turn it out in the case of the shuttle, it's better to do it parallel. So it's going to be a strange-looking thing to take off. The orbiter, it will take off vertically, the way you see it here, in fact, not even the angle that you see it here. It'll be sitting straight on its back, and it will take off vertically the way a rocket does. But all three of the orbiter engines, which are back here, and are thin fuel and oxidizers in that big external tank on the outside, will be firing, and the two solid fuel rockets will be firing. So the whole thing is going to look rather like a bunch of bananas with flames coming out of its end, taking off and flying up into the air. And it will become a familiar sight because the shuttle is going to replace all of our present rockets, and all of the launches throughout the 1980s will be the shuttle, but at the beginning it's going to be kind of startling. What is the shuttle? It is basically a new rocket which will replace all of our present rockets, of which there are about a dozen kinds. It will be used for all space flight throughout the 1980s, manned and unmanned, military and civilian, scientific applications and otherwise. All flight will be manned, and yet it will cut the cost of space flight to one-tenth of what it is now, and I hope that I convinced you that that amount is not a terribly great amount. So the point of that is not that we cut the budgets down to one-tenth of what it is now, but that we can do 10 times as much with the same amount of money. And there will, in fact, be, on the average, through the 1980s, one manned shuttle flight per week. And yet all of that, roughly 52 manned flights per year, will cost about the same as the current total of 25 unmanned launches that we've got now, and will be able to do very much greater. The way the shuttle is able to save so much money, I'll explain in a moment. In addition to saving money, the shuttle will enable us to do things that we cannot do now at any price. For example, carry passengers into orbit, people who are not trained astronauts. I'm not talking about tourists yet. Maybe in the 1990s, in some follow-on version of the shuttle, such as you saw in 2001, shuttle flight would still be expensive enough that you would not expect an individual human to pay for it in general. Typical shuttle flight would be about $13 million in cost, and that is very small compared to what it would cost to do the same sort of thing today, but it's too much for you to pay unless your name happens to be Howard Hughes or J. Paul Getty, and if it is, you're dead, you don't care anyway. So, there will be, however, many non-astronaut passengers who will be flying into space, scientists, military people, agricultural experts, forestry experts, fisheries people, meteorologists, astronomers, of course, one hopes eventually astronomy popularizes and lecturers, all kinds of people of this sort flying into space with separate people, pilot types, what you usually think of as astronauts, to do the actual flying. And this is an inevitable stage in the development of a new transportation technology. You can't expect everybody to do their own flying with an airplane. In the early days of flying in the Earth's atmosphere, if you wanted to fly, you learned how to do it, and you did fly your own airplane. But the chances are you built your own airplane. But nowadays, if you have business which requires that you go to Japan, you fly there, and you do so as a passenger, and there are specialists who are paid to do nothing else, and they're the pilot guys, and they're the ones who worry about actually operating the gadget. You just sit back there and read the magazines and get awards, and fly over all around the Pacific. The shuttle is the same sort of thing. We are hoping that it will do the same kind of thing for space flight as an EC3 did for air flight, and that is bring it out of the spectacular but risky, difficult, early experimental phase into the same kind of routine, practical, everyday, routinely economic situation that we have for air flight. And there's every reason to believe that, in fact, it will. I'll give some examples of that later on. The shuttle will also enable us to do other things that we can't do now at any price. For example, retrieve satellites, unmanned spacecraft, which have malfunctioned in orbit, and either repair them in orbit, since there will be astronauts in every flight, or if they're really tough cases, bring them back to the Earth to be repaired, or even in cases where they have malfunctioned, to be updated. You know, you have a satellite up there, and it's been making lots of good observations for you, and now you have some new gadget, which is a technological improvement, or you've learned from earlier observations that it made that you've now got another question, and you wish you had a different instrument on it. Fine, shuttle retrieves it for you, brings it back, you're able to make a change, it then puts the satellite back into orbit. And as far as malfunctions go, any space engineer can tell you horror stories of some $20 million satellite that failed because of the failure of some 15-cent component that could have been fixed in 5 minutes by a guy on the spot with a screwdriver, but there was no guy on the spot with a screwdriver, and so it was lost, and now there will be somebody on the spot with a screwdriver, and you'll be able to fix them. So the shuttle consists of an orbiter, which needs something else to get it up above the ground. In the case of those tests in California, the something else was the 747. And the purpose of the test was to test the re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere and the landing pattern, which is going to be really hairy for reasons that I'll tell you shortly. It seemed worthwhile to find out how to do that, at least the last 5 miles of it. You know, if you knew the last 5 miles, you knew the whole thing. And it seemed worthwhile to do that before we entrusted a crew and a cargo to an actual space flight. The result, however, is that an incredible number of people seem to think that the shuttle is going to fly into space on the back of a 747. It is not. Okay. But it needs something to get it above the ground. In the case of those tests of the 747, and in the case of the space flight, it's going to be the external tank and the solid rocket boosters. The analogy, remember the shuttle was a rocket. It was in fact the first manned rocket as opposed to spacecraft. And if you don't know the difference, well, we'll be worried somewhat by the shuttle in fact. But basically the idea is the rocket is the truck that gets you there, and the spacecraft is the cargo that you want to get there, the satellite or the lunar reconnaissance probe or whatever it is that you're launching. And the shuttle is is equivalent to a two-stage rocket in which the first stage, which would be on the bottom of one of our present kinds of ordinary throwaway rockets, is the combination of the two solid rocket boosters. The orbiter is the equivalent of the second stage, but it is firing from the moment of takeoff. And in cases where you need a third stage, and about one-third of all the shuttle launches will, there will be a third stage. There are several third stages that are being built now with impressive names like interim upper stage and spinning solid upper stage and typical NASA particle railway in their names. And those will go in an even more unbelievable position. They will go inside the orbiter cargo bay and released into space once you get into orbit. So all the components that you're used to are there. They're just stacked in a rather unusual way. The size of the orbiter, as far as its length goes, or as far as its wingspan goes, is about that of one of the smallest of our commercial jet airliners. But having been there at the moment that it was first rolled out, as well as being lucky enough to go back a year later for those first two of the tests, I can tell you that a lot of people's first reaction, including mine when they first saw it, is, gee, that thing is big. It is higher and wider and bulkier than a jet airline would be. And the impression that you get of size is by no means unjustified. That first Earth satellite of the United States that we launched Explorer 1 a few months after the Soviets had launched Sputnik 1 and 2, that we launched 20 years ago yesterday, was launched with a Jupiter C rocket, you may remember, which was basically a Redstone missile with some small solid fuel upper stages. That entire thing, including the Redstone, could be placed inside the shuttle cargo bay and flown into orbit in its entirety. The shuttle cargo bay is as long as two moving vans placed end to end, 65 feet long, is a cylinder 15 feet in diameter, and depending on the orbit that the shuttle goes into, it could carry into orbit as much as 65,000 pounds on every flight. That means that it could orbit 5 full-grown male African elephants. You call that the herd shot around the world. It could bring back from space. It could bring back from space 32,000 pounds. So at any given flight, you could bring back 2.5 of your elephants, and you'd have to leave the other 2.5 in order for the next trip. Up in the front there is the cabin where the people are, both the pilot types and the passengers. There could be, in extremity, as many as a dozen people in a shuttle flight, although ordinarily it would be a good deal less. And this whole thing, aside from the engine pod back there in the back, and the very small auxiliary fuel tanks, which are on board the orbiter, you see they're very tiny compared to the major one outside there, but they're used for things like maneuvering in orbit, and nudging you back into the Earth's atmosphere at the beginning of that reentry and so forth. Other than that, the entire space inside the orbiter itself is available for passengers and cargo. And what this means is we are going to have capabilities that are going to require just a whole new kind of thinking about what it is that we're able to do in space and what it is that we're not. No longer are we going to have to worry about the kind of ultra-miniaturization that's been such a problem up to this point. In fact, that's an obvious way to tell you why the shuttle saves so much money. It does it for a bunch of reasons, of which probably the most understandable, and therefore the most publicized, turns out, believe it or not actually to be the biggest. It's a big one, but there's some others that are even bigger. And that is the fact that the shuttle is the world's first reusable rocket. So far, all the rockets that we've built have been expendable. That is to say, you throw them away after one mission. You build this huge, enormous, expensive, complicated device, and you throw it away after one use. Well, no mode of transportation is going to be very economical if you do that kind of thing. If we built something the size of the Queen Mary for ocean voyages and used it to do what we did in Apollo, ferry three guys from New York to London and back and then sink it, we wouldn't get very far as economics of ocean voyages went, right? Okay, the only other vehicle in the entire history of transportation, in fact, that I can think of, which was ever used for a single purpose, or for a single voyage, and then thrown away, were the Viking funeral ships. So, with that one single exception, it has been the case in the history of transportation that you go to reusable vehicles from the start. why do we not do it in space? Well, again, go back to a Saturn V rocket with an Apollo spacecraft on its nose, sitting down there in the pad a few years ago at Cape Canaveral, which is called Cape Kennedy then. That thing had 9 million separate parts, which means that if it were only 99% reliable, you would have 99.9% reliable, you would have 9,000 failures during the course of the mission. Obviously, it had to be much more reliable than that, and it was. And the people who designed it had enough to worry about to get it to work once without worrying about whether it would still be working 100 times afterwards. And equally obviously, the next stage after you have learned how to do it perfectly once is to build a vehicle that is capable of doing it over and over. And that's what the shuttle is. So one of the reasons that it saves money is that you don't have to build a new one for every flight. Another reason that it saves money is that it is a specialized vehicle. It does not try to do everything, and so far, all of our rockets have had to do everything. And again, this is obviously necessary at the beginning, in the pioneering stages of a new form of transportation. You can't build a lot of specialized vehicles, you just don't have the traffic for them. But trying to do something with, such as we did in Apollo, where a single vehicle was responsible for getting the crew off the Earth into orbit around the Earth, and then sending them from orbit around the Earth into orbit around the Moon, and then getting them down from the orbit around the Moon onto the lunar surface, and then supporting their stay on the lunar surface, and then getting them back into lunar orbit, and then getting them back into the Earth, lunar orbit, into trajectory towards the Earth, and then for heaven's sake, coming in through the Earth's atmosphere, and at the very end of it, having to float like a boat. All of those things required one single vehicle. Naturally, it was going to be somewhat inefficient compared to a whole series of vehicles which would do the combination of all of those. It's as though you had a single vehicle which would take you from your office down to the street like an elevator, and then take you to the airport like a taxi, and then fly you to San Francisco, and then operate as a cable car and take you up the hill to your hotel. You know, it wouldn't do any of those functions as well as if you had the four separate vehicles that we actually have. So the shuttle is simply the first link in what we hope eventually will become quite a number of vehicles called the Space Transportation System, STS. And the shuttle is the part that does the hardest part of all, and that is to build the first few hundred miles, which is the hardest because that's the part that's going through the Earth's atmosphere, and that's the part that's going through the Earth's heavy gravitational field. The shuttle is the part that goes from the surface of the Earth to low orbit around the Earth, and go no higher above the Earth's surface than 900 miles, and back again. Suppose you want to go 900 miles, higher than 900 miles, which in fact you will for about one-third of the satellite that the shuttle launches. Well, then you have the upper stages, which go into the shuttle cargo bay, and that's exactly analogous to what we do now. You can only use a two-stage rocket to get into fairly low Earth orbit. Beyond that, you got to have a third stage. And about one-third of the shuttle satellite launches will need those upper stages. That's obviously the sort of thing that you need if you're going to the moon or a planet. It's also what you need if you're going into, for example, geosynchronous orbit, the height that is used for so many of the communication satellites, and the height at which you take exactly 24 hours to go around the Earth, so the Earth is turning under you at the same rate as you're moving over it, and you always stay over exactly the same place on the Earth's surface. That is 22,380 miles out, and you cannot reach that with the shuttle itself, in one of the other stages. Okay, so the shuttle saves money because it's reusable and because it's specialized. And the other reasons that it saves money are just a whole combination of individually unspectacular factors which together add up to a lot of the money savings. Just the fact that it's been 15 years now since we last designed and built a big new major rocket, and in that time there have been a lot of technological improvements, and they've all been used. And so for all of those reasons, the cost of going into space will be measured about one-tenth of what it is now. That is a very important set of figures. That is the most important set of figures about space economics. It is more important even than the fact that space is not as expensive as it's cracked up to be, even more important than the fact that it doesn't cost anything that we make money on. The really important thing is that the cost, the money that you have to put out, never mind how much you get back, the cost of doing a particular thing in space has been going down meteorically ever since the space age began. Let me take as an index of the cost of getting into space. what it costs to put 1 pound of payload into a low-Earth orbit. And that, remember, is the most expensive, the most difficult part of even eventually the first part. I'm talking not about the cost of the payload itself, which could be zero or it could be very expensive, depending on what it is. I'm simply talking about the cost of buying a rocket and flying the thing and getting it up there. Well, when the space age began 20 years ago, the Soviet Union and the United States both spent about $1 million to put 1 pound of payload into Earth orbit. It is now, 20 years later, down to about $1,000, if that's a little under. So in just 20 years, less than one human generation, the cost has gone down to 0.1% of what it started at. The shuttle is going to get it down to the order of $100. It's going to knock off an additional zero. You would have to knock off only one more zero, get it down by one more factor of 10, and that is entirely possible even during the shuttle era, simply by continuing cumulative small improvements in the way that the vehicle is put together each time and is flown and so forth. Get it down to $10 a pound, and spaceflight is economically competitive to long-distance air transport. You could send yourself or cargo around the Earth today in a 747 for about $10 per pound of your body weight or the weight of that cargo. What I'm trying to tell you is, in my opinion, the single most important current political fact. And you will understand why I say that better after you've heard the space conversation about you next year. Because it is this fact that spaceflight is becoming so cheap that makes things like as ambitious as space colonization economically reasonable. That fact means that the era of cheap, routine, everyday, economically reasonable spaceflight is not only not impossible, it is not even some impossible dream of the hopelessly remote future. It is virtually upon us. It is going to happen in the lifetime of essentially everybody in this room. It is going to happen in the next 10 years or so, in fact. That is what the shuttle is about. This is a closer view of the orbiter. This, here the artist has turned the light around so we can see it a little bit more easily. You can see that the cabin where the passengers go is divided into two floors, two layers. And up top there is where you fly. There are two seats which face forward for the pilot and the co-pilot, although they aren't called, they have to call the commander and the pilot. And then there are two seats which in fact face backwards for two other people who will not always be in every flight. For example, you've got only the commander and the pilot in the test flight. And not every spaceflight is going to have the same number of people. That's something else we're going to have to get used to. Those are the astronauts who are called the mission specialists. And that describes what they do. They're not primarily responsible for flying. They will be taught enough flying that should there be an emergency, they'd be able to get home safely. But ordinarily, they wouldn't do the driving. They would be primarily responsible for the operations in orbit once they get up there. This means that any of you who would like to be astronauts, and I'm sure there are many of the kids in the audience, for example, who are thinking about that, and perhaps some of the ones that are a little bit older than kids, it's going to be a lot easier. In fact, it's already a lot easier because the first set of mission specialists has already been selected. And in fact, that happened when their names were announced last week. The mission specialist class is not going to have to be this sort of impossible superhuman combination of incredible brilliance and incredible physical strength and stamina that we're used to thinking of astronauts as being. The pilot astronauts are still going to have to be pretty much that way. But anybody of normal health, normal intelligence, normal physical situation ought to be able to make it as a mission specialist. Of course, it'd still be highly competitive, so in practice, everybody doesn't have a chance. But if you can't make it as a mission specialist, you've still got the possibility of making it as a payload specialist, which is the official designation for the passengers. And the payload specialists are guys who just go along for a single flight in order to operate their own particular experiments or make their own particular observations in space. And so if there are people in the audience who are young enough that they're thinking in terms of making career choices now, and they're interested in going into space, very often I talk to such people, and of course they're generally present, they have to learn to be astronauts, you know, and they say in many cases, well, gee, I'm not particularly into flying, I just want to go into space. And you don't have to be into flying anymore. If you're into flying, that's great. Then you're one of the pilot types. And you might be interested in trying to become a pilot astronaut. But if you just want to go into space, you couldn't care less how you get there, then simply set out to be the best astronomer or agricultural expert or whatever it is that you're interested in anyway, and bear in mind as you're thinking of doctoral thesis and that sort of thing, that you are interested in going into space, and so do something that is vaguely related to that, and your chances will be very good of getting up there sometime during the 1980s or later. Passengers would tend to be down there in the bottom bay when they take off, and that is also where sleeping, eating, cooking, where the bathroom would be, that sort of thing, and the nose where most of the living would go on. And in the cargo bay, well, that's more complicated, and we'll get to that. Let me show you what a typical shuttle flight will look like, so as to give you an idea of what kind of vehicles put together and why. This is an artist drawing, a cutaway of the vehicle assembly building down in Cape Canaveral, which was, at the time it was built, the largest building on Earth, in terms of interior volume, even bigger than the Great Pyramid. It is still one of the largest now is a building out in Seattle, in fact, where Boeing built the 747. But this is still one of the very biggest. It was built for Apollo to handle Saturn V, and it is simply being reused now, modified somewhat, and rebuilt a little bit, but basically the same thing, in order to handle the shuttle. And in general, the same one that the shuttle uses. My favorite story about the vehicle assembly building is illustrated size, which is difficult to appreciate, unfortunately, because it's sitting out there in a flat floor of a plane, and there's nothing really that gives you an impression of scale until you get really close to it and notice those things you thought were ants crawling around the ground were actually people. It's disappointing when you see it, but my favorite story that gives you some notion about it is that they discovered after they built the thing that they had to air condition the entire side of the building at considerable additional cost because clouds were forming and rain was falling inside the building. That same structure is going to be used for the shuttle. Here you see an orbiter being transported in, and some of the, those are external tanks, and one of them, the one that's going to be made into that orbiter, is already in place there in one of the high bays with the solid rocket boosters fastened to the side of it. The next thing will be to bring the orbiter in, make it vertical, and fasten it onto the side, and it's already on the crawler transporter, which will then carry it out to the pad. The whole thing of checkout and preparation is going to be very, very much shorter for the shuttle, much simpler and therefore shorter than it was for the Apollo, which took months to get ready for a single flight. The hope is that eventually they'll get down to the point where an orbiter can fly into space, come back to the Cape, and be ready for another flight, completely ready and checked out on the pad again in just 2 weeks. They won't be doing that in the beginning, but that's the ultimate goal. Back here, you have a new building, something new that has to be built for the shuttle, and that is the Orbiter Processing Facility, or OPS. When it is ready, the transporter will take it out of the vehicle assembly building, we'll have a rollout, just as we had for the Apollo Saturn flight, and that's quite a spectacular thing to see. Well, the aspect over here, because although the shuttle weighs almost as much as the Saturn V, and is has rockets which will give about the thrust of a Saturn V. That may be another idea of power. It's only going into low Earth orbit, and yet it's just about as powerful a rocket as a Saturn V was going all the way to the moon. Nevertheless, it's not anything like as tall as a Saturn V, which is as tall as a 30-story building. And so it's wider and about as heavy, but it's not as high. And the height of the vehicle assembly building is not comparable to this or the Saturn V was. The takeoff will be vertical, as I mentioned, from the pad at Cape Canaveral, or later on, starting in 1983, from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California as well. The reason for having two sites is, first of all, the way you can have more flights, but secondly, from Vandenberg, you can do things that you cannot do from Cape Canaveral. That is to say, you can fly into an orbit which takes you directly over the poles of the Earth, and that's valuable for things like Earth observation, obviously, meteorology satellites, Earth resources satellites, that kind of thing. We haven't been able to do that in any place so far. You cannot go due north or due south, and you've got to do one or the other to go over the poles. You cannot do either of those from Cape Canaveral because if you look at a map of Florida,
as out of the East Coast, you will find that either one would require that you would fly over populated areas. And that is a no-no. You're not allowed to fly over populated areas with a rocket. The citizens of Miami, for some reason, keep complaining about the idea of having Saturn V flying over their heads. The theory being that someday one of them might not fly over their heads. So, only from Vancouver Air Force Base is there a space facility in which you can fly, in this case, due south over the Pacific and go into a polar orbit. So, that would be the second U.S. manned space facility. The takeoff will be vertical, like a rocket. The artist here has drawn, as artists always do, except the very accurate ones of whom was one, John Davis, currently working, and so did myself. He's just drawn it as a uniform trail of red. And I have been trying to find out, and so far failing, just how spectacular the flame in a shuttle takeoff is going to be. The reason for that is that one of the disappointments of my life is that I was not able to go to Cape Canaveral for the night launch of Apollo 17, the only time a Saturn V ever took off at night, and that was visible for 300 miles. And, of course, the idea was to get very much closer to it than that. Since the shuttle is about as big and powerful as Saturn V, and since there will be so many flights, one of these days there's got to be a night launch, and I want to find out if it's going to be anything like comparable, and so far nobody's been able to tell me that. The solid rocket boosters are firing along with the orbiter engine, and the solid rocket boosters burn themselves out at a height of 27 miles and separate. The orbiter continues to fire its engine, so there's still fuel and oxidizer in that tank, although enough left of it now that the whole thing weighs enough less that you don't need the solid rockets anymore, and that's why they decided they work. The solid rockets are reusable also. They parachute back into the ocean, and they are recovered by ships. I doubt there will ever be a time when they come this close to the recovery ship, artistic license and all that, but nevertheless, that's a basic idea. That would be about 100 miles offshore out in the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean, as the case may be. The orbiter continues to go into toward space, but just before it gets into space, when it has when it has 95% of its orbital velocity of 18,000 miles an hour, the external tank is separated. And since it does not quite have enough speed to go into orbit, what it does is do a long looping path almost halfway around the Earth, re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and burn up. You say, now wait a minute, the whole thing about the shuttle is it's reusable, and here is the largest part of it, and yet it's going to burn up. And we will have to build a new external tank for every single shuttle flight. Yes, but although the tank is the largest part of the shuttle, it is also the simplest part. I mean, it's just a tank. Well, it's a little more to it than that. It has about as many parts as the average automobile. But it's still the simplest part of the shuttle. And it turns out that if you were going to bring that back into the Earth's atmosphere, you would need to put a heat shield on it. And a heat shield is always a very heavy thing, particularly considering that this heat shield has got to be reusable. You can't have a throwaway heat shield the way you had on all the earlier re-entry vehicles. So the heat shield, which does have to enclose the orbiter, does not have to enclose the very much larger volume of the external tank if you throw away the external tank each time. This was something that somebody thought of years and years into the shuttle design period. Originally the idea had been, because this is the way it would always go rocket, to have the tank inside the orbiter, and so the orbiter would have been very much larger than in fact it actually is, and all of that would have had to be enclosed in the heat shield. And finally, an engineer at Grumman Aerospace got a brilliant idea of having this one part of the shuttle expendable and not having to put a heat shield around it. As a result of that single decision, the cost of the shuttle plummeted. It went to, they cut them like one-third of the total cost. You have to spend more money because you're building a new tank now with each flight, but you save so much more money by not having to have that heavy heat shield over this volume, and therefore not having as much weight to put up into orbit the way of the additional heat shield, and therefore not having to spend additional money on fuel and additional money on fuel to lift that additional fuel, and so on and so forth. It's ruinously expensive whenever you add more weight in a space vehicle. You're always trying to save weight in space. Like, you save so much money there that it makes the shuttle look even more beautiful than it had up to that point. And a lot of people thought that Grumman was going to get the contract to build the shuttle for just that reason. They did, as it turned out, North American Rockwell did, but which is now Rockwell International. But Grumman does have some important subcontract work, and that was one of the major things that were done. It's amazing how simple design changes sometimes can make a tremendous difference. For example, when this final design was almost frozen, some engineer, again Grumman in fact, discovered that by changing the shape of the wing, they could cut 2 million hours off the cost of each shuttle flight, because it would be possible to make it a little bit lighter in weight. And, well, of course, you know, that's what you pay engineers for, but it is very remarkable how well they are very often able to do it, and some of these problems are capable of solving. So the external tank goes back into the Earth's atmosphere. Now, I say with burnout, that's the theory, and of course, as always with a large space vehicle coming into the Earth's atmosphere, there's often that this thing will be longer than the longest spacecraft that has ever actually been orbited, in fact, which is Saturn, which is Skylab. And in fact, the orbit itself, every time it goes into orbit, will tie the record for the second biggest spacecraft ever launched. So, I beg your pardon, Skylab is the second biggest, this will be the third biggest. The biggest was the second of the two Echo balloons, which was 135 feet in diameter, and it was just a big hollow balloon, you know, so it's kind of cheating to include it. Well, there's always a question about whether it will completely burn up. We've got that worry about Skylab right now. If it does not burn up, however, some portion of it survives and hits the ocean, the place where it will come down will be for an Atlantic launch in the far southern Indian Ocean, almost Antarctic waters, and for a Pacific launch, for a Vandenberg Air Force Base launch, it'll be in Antarctic waters in the very far southern Pacific Ocean. So there's just nobody there except a few Soviet and Japanese whalers. And so you see, once again, the shuttle is ecologically desirable. The orbiter then continues on into orbit, getting the remaining 5% of the velocity by using those small onboard engines, which are called the OMS, Orbiter Maneuvering System. There's also an even smaller set, which is called the Attitude Control System, or ACS, and is used for either very minor orbit changes or for changing the position of the spacecraft in space. You know, it can point any way it wants, but you gotta keep it pointing in that direction, and if you want to change it, then you have to make a change. So the OMS engines, with those small additional fuel tanks that you saw in the cutaway, get into orbit the remaining 5%, and the orbit will be, in a typical case, about 200 miles up. It can be as much as 850 miles up. Now, what the shuttle does when it gets into orbit will be, in the first place, probably a number of things for each flight, and in the second place, highly variable. So again, you got to do some rethinking. It's not going to be as easy to describe this as you would for, say, an Apollo mission where you did basically the same things every time. So generalizations that I make in the remainder of this lecture, in fact, ones that I've already made, may have some exceptions. But here's a typical sort of thing that it might do. This shows the launching of an unmanned satellite, and about two-thirds of the shuttle flight will be either to launch or to retrieve or both unmanned satellites. These are unmanned vehicles, but if anything goes wrong with them, you have human beings there to fix them. And so there's this old argument about whether manned or unmanned spaceflight is better, in which the manned advocates say, if anything goes wrong, you got to have people there because the unmanned equipment isn't flexible, and the unmanned people say, yeah, but ours is so much cheaper, and it's more reliable, and you don't have to bring it back to the Earth, you don't have to feed it while it's in orbit, and that sort of thing. All that's going to disappear. We've got the best of both worlds now. The way that you will handle a satellite, this particular one would have had solar panels all folded up. It's an astronomical satellite, a big telescope there, so I think it, and it's dear to my heart. The solar panels would have been all folded up and so forth in the cargo bay. You remove it. The payload specialist, the mission specialist rather, perhaps working with the payload specialist, working through rear windows there, you can see the two top windows they use also, and then there are rear windows around there in the rear cabin facing the cargo bay. We use this manipulator arm, of which there can be one, and it can be mounted on either side of the cargo bay, or there can be two if necessary, and that is being built and paid for by Canada. There is an example of the several types of international cooperation which are going into the shuttle. Canada is paying for that, and in exchange, Canadian astronauts and Canadian unmanned vehicles will both fly on shuttle flight. The manipulator arm will gently pick it up, move it out into space, and then they'll check it out, they'll unfold all the solar panels and do whatever has to be done to set it up, and then gently remove it and
move the shuttle away beyond this or the attitude control system, and there you will be that satellite launch. No threat, no problem. If anything goes wrong at the last minute, okay, you either fix it if that's possible, or you bring it back and no harm has been done.
Here is a typical example of a satellite which is being launched into an orbit that is higher than the shuttle can get to. This particular one is an Intelsat 4B communication satellite, so I'm sure it's going up to a geosynchronous orbit. There is one of the two upper stages. I can't tell you which one this is because this is an artist's inception several years old, and in fact neither of the two that are actually being built will look exactly like this. The interim upper stage is being built and bought and paid for by the Air Force, and that is the military's contribution to the show. I might mention there are five orbiters who are being built. There will be the pretty strict separation we've had up to this point, which in my opinion is a good idea, between the civilian and the military space program. You'll have that in the show here as well. And it will, the military will have two of its own orbiters, and they will fly them separately, and NASA will have three orbiters. And since the military runs Vandenberg Air Force Base, and NASA runs Kennedy Space Center, whoever is running the particular sensors or launch run will be controlling that particular operation. But the military will get value out of the shuttle, and so NASA said, listen guys, you got more money than we have, you got to pay for some of this. And the end result was the Air Force Base, the IUS, the interim upper stage. There's also something called a spinning solid upper stage, in which you have a little turntable gadget, which starts at spinning, that gets stabilized very easily and cheaply, and then boing, the springs off it goes, and goes flying up to a higher orbit. That will be used for a lot of the planetary flights, for example, the Jupiter Orbiter Probe, which will be the first planetary flight that is launched from the shuttle in the early 1980s. About one-third of the shuttle flight will be spacewalk. I don't like that name, spacewalk. It seems to have been chosen with malice aforethought to confuse as many people as possible, because it sounds so much like skywalk. And in fact, spacewalk has had several names already, and every one of them has been better than that, in my opinion, but spacewalk it is. Spacewalk is also a national cooperation. It is being built and paid for by a consortium of European nations, the European Space Agency, and again, what they get out of that is that their people and experiments will fly both in space lab flight and unmanned shuttle flights. Space lab will be an enormously versatile set of possible laboratories which will do the same sorts of things as Skylab did, that is, manned experiments, manned observations in space, things where you want human scientists along, and of course, this is where you're going to have a lot of your payload specialists, like the passenger types. This is just one of many configurations the space lab might have. It's a combination astronomical and Earth resources mission. There is a big telescope. Here is some Earth observation equipment, which at the moment is not pointing at the Earth, so they must be doing something else. And there is the cutaway of the place where the people are. Basically, space lab has two components of which you don't have to have all, or you can have several of each. You don't have to have any of each in a particular place. It's very versatile. What you can have is what are called pallets, which are outside, which are things that are not pressurized, there's no air in them, so you can't get out them once you go outside and you need another spacewalk. And then you have the thing which is just inelegantly called the space lab module, or the front part of the module and the rear part of the experiment section, more NASA parts where you can see. That is the part where people will be working inside in a shear sleeve environment. It's really sort of mini Skylab. Space lab missions could last up to 28 days. That's the official version, and I'm quite sure we'll be finding they go much further. For example, you could have a second shuttle fly up, rendezvous with the first one, bring up some more consumables, and so on. The Russians have already pioneered that kind of thing with their double docking with Soyuz 6, which you saw just a few weeks ago. And that indicates that even with their current generation of unmanned, expendable vehicles, rather, they're interested in having long-duration manned flights that have to be resupplied from the ground. Well, they're going to be doing the same sort of thing. So basically, Space Lab is a small space station which flies in the shuttle cargo bay. And someday, there may very well be larger space stations, and of course, eventually space colonies, that's a separate story. The shuttle will fly directly to the larger space stations. That would be the next thing that NASA would like to do sometime in the mid-1980s. Whether they get the money for it, of course, is anybody's guess. Originally, way back when the shuttle was first being proposed, it was thought of as simply an auxiliary to a space station program. And it was going to be the vehicle that flew people off the back, and that was all there was to it. It was obvious that a reusable vehicle was necessary to save money for that, because there were going to have to be so many flights. And then two things became slowly obvious. Number one, the politicians worried about the release of money for a large space station program. And number two, there were an awful lot of good reasons for building the shuttle just by itself. And so it evolved into its present form. But it may end up supporting space station activity anyway. This is a view inside the cabin of the shuttle, of the orbiter. And you can see four astronauts there, two of them who are probably payload specialists, who are looking through those windows, and the top window that's up here has been cut away. There's a manipulator arm back in the cargo bay, and two of them who are pilot types who are at the moment doing things with instruments. They would be sitting here and here when they were flying and looking through these windows that are shown in outline. So down here on the bottom is the lower bay, and you can see tables, you can see food storage compartments. This would be cooking equipment here. These are storage cabinets, and there is the shuttle toilet, just barely visible. This is not an airlock. You would not use this to get out of the space. The airlock would be back under here, and you can't see it. There's a tunnel that runs through to it, and it would be used only on certain missions. This is the door that you go in and out of the shuttle on the ground, and you'll see pictures of the astronauts in at the end of the test, in the beginning of the test flight, going in through that door. You'll notice that one of the astronauts is female and another one is black, and that is quite realistic. And in fact, maybe my assignment of roles is wrong then, because all of the pilot astronauts who have just been chosen, the new ones, together, of course, with all the ones we've already got, are both male and white, but a number of the mission specialist astronauts who have just been chosen are women. A number of them are black, and in fact, we have one who is both female and orientalist in. NASA went to a lot of trouble this time to get active participation in the astronaut selection program from both minorities and women. And they were quite worried for a while there that they were getting so few applications. And so they really started advertising, and they did things like sending Michelle Jackson, who played Lieutenant O'Hara in Star Trek, around to speak to likely minority audiences and try to pronounce some participation, and indeed they didn't get so. You're probably aware that the Soviet Union has flown one female cosmonaut, Valentina Tereshkova, in Vostok 5, 15 years ago, this coming June, but in fact I think it's 15 years ago, it's coming Father's Day, but that was quite obviously, in retrospect, a political stunt and nothing more. And they'd never flown another woman, and there were stories which were probably true at the time about how she was very badly trained and got herself into some trouble as a result. Her previous flying experience consisted of poor parachuting, and that is just not what's happening here. There really will be women and minorities, and they're really being integrated well into the program. The point where we knew that NASA was really sincere about wanting women in the next round of astronaut selection was when they specified a considerable additional expense that the shuttle toilet must be usable by either sex. That is sincerity. There were, in fact, 8,000 people of both sexes and all races who applied in this astronaut selection program, and of those, about 30 were chosen. So you can see it's still pretty hard to get in, but there will be additional selections in the future. This is by no means your last chance, if any of you are interested. This is another picture of the flight deck. This was painted a little earlier, and all four of them were white males. I was amused to see in Astronomy Magazine a few months ago that this painting has now been redone, and that one is now a woman. They got long hair sticking out from under the helmet, and this one has been made black. The idea, however, was just to give you an idea of what some of the gadgetry looks like. That control panel is somewhat misleading, though, because it's not like the control panel of a car or even of a light plane, in which basically you've got one control to do one function. Here, it's so complicated. There's so many things that have to be done, so many decisions that have to be made on the basis of facts that have to be sensed and acted on immediately, that humans are not going to be able to fly the thing directly. Instead, what you have is an exceedingly elaborate computer which does the actual flying, and you simply tell it what you want to do, and it does the rest for you. It's the one who carries out the actual decision. So it takes a kind of thinking to fly the shuttle orbiter, which is different from what you're used to in a car. You don't have quite the same feeling of control, and you have got to have a very good sense of what the limitations of that computer are, what you can and cannot reasonably ask it to do. otherwise you could be in trouble. So that's the reason that you still have the gung-ho pilot types that are required to sit in those two seats up there and do the actual flying of it. So far, I've shown you nothing but artist conceptions. This is a picture of the actual flight deck of the first shuttle orbiter that was built, number 101, the Enterprise, and those are two of the astronauts who have been doing the test flight. It was not fully built at the time this picture was taken. They didn't have the cathode ray tube displayed in there, for example, but it gives you, again, a good idea of what the flight deck looks like. It's got pretty decent windows, too, for once you've got a spacecraft you can see out of well. When the shuttle re-enters the Earth's atmosphere after a mission of anywhere from several days to as much as a month, or more, in fact, it will do so in a very air-raided manner. First of all, the orbital maneuvering system engines will be fired to reduce its speed slightly, and it will come into the Earth's atmosphere 80 miles up at a speed of 16,000 miles an hour. That must be reduced to zero by the time it lands. Well, the way you do that is the way you always have done it to get back into the Earth's atmosphere, and that is use the atmosphere itself, use the friction of that atmosphere for braking, and that involves very high temperatures, as high as the place where you see it glowing right here, 2700 degrees Fahrenheit. The way that that's always been handled in the past was to have an ablative heat shield, that is to say, a material which is heated by the atmospheric friction and which is vaporized and is carried off by the airflow, and as it is carried off, it removes itself so fast that the heat simply does not have a chance to transmit itself to the interior. That sounds incredible, but it actually works. In fact, the same thing is true of meteorites, and that's where they got the idea. The outer portion of a meteorite burns itself away so rapidly that the inner portion is usually stone cold by the time it hits the surface. And people who run over and pick it up and are worried because they expect to burn themselves are amazed because, in fact, it's actually the cold of outer space. The hot part has already been evaporated off the outside. Well, fine, you can't use that for the shuttle because the whole point of the shuttle is that it's reusable. And so they had to do it the hard way. They had to find substances which not only could stand being heated to temperatures as high as 2700 degrees, but could do it repeatedly, time after time after time, for a minimum of 100 flights, which is the design goal for each of the orbits. They found five such materials, some of which are more heat resistant than others. The more heat resistant ones tend to be the heavier ones, and so they're used only where it's absolutely necessary, and so all five of them actually are being applied. Those heat tiles were some of the heat tiles were among the most difficult problems in actually building the thing, because it turned out that the shape of the orbiter, although it looks fairly simple, is actually complicated enough that it wasn't possible to mass produce the tiles. Each one had to be hand fabricated for its particular shape at its particular location on the orbiter surface, which means that you had to go all the way back to the days before Henry Ford. And I'm sure you remember from elementary school how, you know, the assembly line may not be the greatest environment in the world to work in, but it was a tremendous efficiency improvement in the history of technology, made possible things like relatively expensive automobiles, and you had to go back to the days before that. Well, that meant that the manufacturers of these tiles, who after all are in business to make some sort of a profit, had a really difficult time of it. Ordinarily, if you were just mass producing large numbers of interchangeable and independent ones, well, you say, okay, they're not all going to be perfect, some of them are going to have to be flawed, but we'll make 10% more than we need, and that's what's going to cost us all that much more, and then we'll throw away the 10% that aren't good. And we can keep it down to a 10% failure rate, we're still okay. Couldn't do it that way because everyone had a separate shape. So the quality control problems are really fierce, quite along with the manufacturing problem. The materials themselves are equally remarkable. Here is a sample, a cube, of the material which is responsible for the greatest amount of heat shielding, the one that we use in 2700 degree plates. This man is holding a cube of it in his bare hand. It is white hot. It dissipates heat so rapidly that it's not burning it. As a matter of fact, all of the illumination in this picture comes from that white hot cube of glowing thermal tile. 30 seconds later, in the final picture, because it's black and white, so you can't tell, but they tell us it had already cooled to red heat, even in the centers of the faces, and cooler than that at the edges where it cools most rapidly. Quite remarkable stuff. Well, you come into the atmosphere, and that heating period lasts only for a few minutes, and then you start flying downwards. Now, you have to understand something important about the orbit. It looks like an airplane. However, it very decidedly does not fly like an airplane. The word is, in fact, that it flies very much like a rock. It comes down at a vertical rate of descent of 1 mile per minute. And that is only half as great as the horizontal rate. It's only between 2 and 3 times as great as that. So it is coming in through the atmosphere at an angle like this, with no fuel on board. Remember, we threw away the fuel tank even before we got into orbit. This is the world's largest glider. It has got to come down from orbit and land precisely on a runway. It'll come down on a land here, no more of these ocean landings. In fact, in emergency, it could land at any commercial airport with a 10,000-foot runway. So in emergency, for example, Detroit Metro. So in emergency, you have possible landing sites all over the Earth. In practice, they wouldn't like to do that, but if it's necessary, it would in fact be possible. Well, it comes in then in this unpowered gliding reentry at a vertical rate of descent of more than 1 mile per minute. I say it looks like an airplane, it doesn't fly like one. The reason it looks like an airplane turns out to be almost coincident. In fact, these things that look like wings do not function as wings. The thing that looks like a tail is there for a different reason than the tail on an airplane and so on and so forth. And it seems that it's a little different, would have had a quite different shape. The aerodynamically most significant surface on the orbiter is the bottom surface, and that is a lifting body shape, a gentle curve, which doesn't look at all like the bottom of an aircraft. And that's the one where it's actually flying in this picture when we're actually in the landing. Just short of the runway, it is still going at almost the speed of sound. And it pitches up its nose at that point at a 45-degree angle and slows itself using air friction so violently that again the underside glows cherry red. They then lower the nose and land at 230 miles an hour. Those tires are impressive. The landing will be either at Cape Canaveral, and this is the way those facilities will work. There you see the vehicle assembly building and all the things you used to, the car rail, pad 39, and so forth, and a new facility, which has already been built several years ago, in fact, the runway, where it will land. A 2-mile-long runway sounds large only when we're not seeing it from this kind of perspective. It's going to require quite a bit of piloting and some pretty good computers. At Vandenberg, the landing will look like this, and there you see the runway looking even smaller. We obviously chosen to show it a little bit farther away. This is Point Arquello on the California coast, in case you're wondering where Vandenberg is. That's up the coast of it from Los Angeles. The first 4 shuttle test flights into orbit, however, next year, there will be something in the order of 6 to 8 test flights next year, depending on how well the schedule goes. The first 4 of those will land in the same place as the test flights have landed, and that is Edwards Air Force Base in the Mojave Desert in California. That has been used for test flights of many different kinds of aircraft, both military and civilian, for a long time. The NASA Drive and Flight Research Center is there, and that's who's sponsoring the test flights of the shuttle orbiter. The point of that is that in addition to a 2-mile-long runway, you've got 8 miles of overrun on the bed of Rogers Dry Lake. And that is a very comforting feeling if you're not certain that you're going to be able to hit those first 2 miles on the first attempt. Well, I've got 7 minutes left, and in that time, I want to rapidly run through some pictures of the first orbiter in various stages of its career. Here, for example, I have one more concession. It's inside the orbiter processing facility, and as you see, they have taken it apart to some extent. Of course, everything had to be removed from the cargo bay, and the new cargo will be put in. They remove the main engines and check them out, and, the usual thing, check the spark plugs, check the tires, check the oil, wash the windshield, that kind of thing. And it can be ready eventually for another flight into space in as little as 2 weeks. Okay, here is the first orbiter, number 101, the Enterprise, in an advanced stage of construction at the Rockwell International Plant in Palmdale, California, which is also in the Mojave Desert. I was fortunate enough to be at the runway at the rollout in September of 1976, and there is the first view that we ever had of a real shuttle orbiter. And people, I can tell you, I went to that I've been out there in California for biking anyway, and by sheer coincidence, it happened to be literally on the day that I had to go pass by there on the way home anyway. And so, you know, I figured, fine, I'll get myself accredited, detour a little bit, you know, send in a routine report and then do it. And I expected to be bored stiff by the whole thing. And I'll tell you something, I wasn't. It was a really emotional situation. There were tears in a lot of eyes, and I'm not ashamed to admit mine were among them. For a reason that may or may not be something that I can convey to you, it depends on how much you've been into this and for how long a time. All these things that I've told you about the show, all the lectures that I've given up to this point, with minor changes of tense and that kind of thing, I could have given you 5 years ago. Because the show has been a long time in the design and planning and building and testing stages. And it had been a dream. It had been an ideal for so long in the minds of so many of us. And I had given, in fact, so many lectures about it and tried to convince so many people it was a good thing and gotten so frustrated by politicians that were fighting it. And I'll tell you, I think the reason that they were was they realized it was their last chance to stop space. Once the shuttle gets going, there are going to be so many good things we'll be doing, and the value of it will be so blatantly obvious to any idiot, even to a senator, that there's just no way you're going to be able to hold it back. This was the last chance to slip your finger in the dike. And I think that's the reason that some very emotional, very biased, very unfortunate arguments were used, especially in the early days of the shuttle's budget battles in Congress. And I am very happy to say, despite the snide remark I just made about politicians, that in fact, year after year, every time the federal opponents tried to get it cut out of the budget, they failed by a smaller and smaller margin, and eventually just got to the point where the support for it was so obviously overwhelming in Congress that they just stopped trying. And so the majority of them, the comments that I made, don't necessarily fully apply to. But you know, it had been a long fight, and it had been a dream for so long. And then all of a sudden, there it was, the real thing. And you know, I hadn't really believed it up to that point. I mean, intellectually, of course, I knew why I was there. But emotionally, I was still thinking of it as I had 5 years or 10 years earlier, as a dream, as something that someday was going to happen. And all of a sudden, there it was, and it was so big, and it was so real. And it was really a tremendous moment. The speeches were just as boring as I expected, but the event itself was something that I will remember as long as I live. And I wanted to show you these pictures just to try to share that with you. The rollout, you know, wasn't as obviously spectacular as the approach and the landing test, and you may not have seen as many pictures of that. Well, there it is. It was named, as you probably know, for the spaceship in Star Trek. As a result of a national letter-writing campaign to get it done. And the point of that is not that, okay, you know, one more victory for dumb American pop culture. It doesn't matter what it was named. The point of this was that it was a deliberate attempt to organize something that people like me, you know, fake popularizers, have known for a long time is out there, and that is public interest and enthusiasm for space. But it is so unorganized. So often it happens that I give a lecture like this, and somebody comes up to me afterwards and says, in effect, gee, I think space is ruined, it's a shame everybody else does it. You know, and I always tell them, listen, if you heard that as many times as I have, you wouldn't think that everybody else does it. In fact, there's a lot of interest out there, but people don't know it, you know, and so many people think they're the only ones. This was a deliberate attempt to organize the one place where there is the organized interest, to tap into that, namely the science fiction fans, and try to get them involved in something involved in a real space program. And of course you start out with something that's totally symbolic and doesn't cost the politicians anything, and it's simple, trivial, and easy to achieve. And even that little thing very nearly failed. NASA, with typical public relations idiocy, which is a major problem, I'm convinced that NASA is 95% of its own problem, fought every step of the way. They had their own name, and they wanted that name, and they didn't care if 20,000 people wrote letters to the president, which is an astonishing number of letters, even for what is generally considered a major issue, like Vietnam or something. They didn't care about all that. They had their own name, constitution, and they didn't care about all those taxpayers. Well, fortunately, it was an election year, and it was probably that close, I was told, quite frankly, by one of the organizers of the campaign, but in an election year, I think President Ford would have done it. But he did do it, he overruled NASA, and there it is, and 20,000 people can look at that and see that something that they did had a real input into the real space program, and now the same people who recognize that are doing some very serious thinking about what to ask for next. That might not be as symbolic. Space colonization, of course, is one of the things you're thinking about. And the problem is that's such a big one. So that's an awful big jump. Maybe something in the media. Well, okay, so much for that. You see what I mean? It's big. It's a large object. It's bigger than you think from the descriptions of the same size as a small jet aircraft. Well, this is quite a moment too. It looks so primitive. I think it was such a shock to come around there and realize that was my first reaction. It was on display there because it is the same place. The American Rockwell, back when they were with American Rockwell, had only about Apollo command modules too. But it just looked so different. I said so much earlier.
And so tiny!
Can you imagine spending a 2-week mission inside that whole thing? I should point out that the Enterprise is a test vehicle, and in fact has been so thoroughly modified for these atmospheric tests that I have been quite a bit of rebuilding before it can fly into space, and that includes this nose probe, which is for weather measurements in the Earth's atmosphere. This is where the attitude control system is, and those are just blank pieces of metal, there's nothing in there. In fact, the engines around the back are fake, and all the thermal towers are fake. They haven't built them yet, and so they just put on ones for the atmospheric test, the group didn't have, and they just put on ones that simulate the weight and aerodynamic characteristics of. The Enterprise is not the first one that will fly into space in March of next year. That is number 102, which is in the final stages of being constructed right now at Palmdale. It has not been given a name yet, so I have to call it 102. I would be willing to bet you almost anything that's going to be called Constitution. That's my own private position. The next thing they have to do is truck it, and I mean literally truck it, over 27 miles of desert highway to every Air Force base. In order to do that, they built on the desert highway. I mean, the Mojave Desert is not exactly the thickest highway net in the earth. And in digging for this new road, they hit on a major new archaeological site. So they said we reroute the road around that, and the archaeologists are out there excavating it right now, and they expect to learn some things about paleo Indians in the Mojave Desert. I'm big on space spin-off and everything, but this is the only case I can think of offhand the manned space program as aided paleo Indian archaeology. The only route they could find took it through downtown Lancaster, California, and essentially the entire town turned out and cheered as it went by, and the story is, I wasn't there for that, this is a picture that I printed out of Time magazine, but the story is it was very quite a festive occasion, also a very beautiful one, because it took 7 hours to do it, they started long before sunrise, and the picture of this surreal, futuristic-looking vehicle with that incredible black and white paint job that they've got on it, that's not a fake, that's necessary for thermal reasons, but it certainly is an impressive-looking vehicle, and that, moving through the desert sunrise, silhouetted against that equally incredible Joshua Tree desert they've got out there, it must have been quite a sight to see. I'm sorry that I wasn't there for it. They had to truck it, because so far they hadn't learned how to fly it in the back of the 747 yet. So they had to do a lot of test flights of the combination of this weird airplane with another big airplane on its back, which had never been done before in anything like that way, before they dared to risk it. And so the first one had to be trucked, and they built this special transport of 96 individual wheels